Hello, I'm Mishka.
Hi, I'm Husband Stoff.
And you're listening to Deviant, a true crime podcast. In this episode, we'll be discussing the acid bath murderer, John George Haig. This episode contains content some people may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised.
Murder!
Murder! So, we've been in quarantine now for nearly 6 months.
Is it?
Yeah, 23rd of March.
Really?
Yeah.
Crikey.
And I've officially run out of things to do.
I don't know how time works anymore.
So, my name's Mishka, and I have strong-armed my lovely husband here, who has really almost zero interest in true crime, into starting a true crime podcast with me, because there's only so many times that he can sit on the other side of me in our home office and watch me pull horrified, amused, or gross out faces.
Well, to be fair, this goes from before it all started as well.
No, so I know.
Because I used to pick you up from work and you'd be like, oh, I heard about this new serial killer today. And
I have a very boring job.
He made
job.
Earrings out of people's kidneys.
I have a very boring job. So I've gone from being a consumer of true crime podcasts to
a
deciding
perpetrator
that
of true crime.
Of true, a podcast. I'm not criminal.
Work in progress.
Okay.
We'll get there one day.
So anyway, yes. Neither of us are criminologists, psychologists, or in any way qualified to do this, but we've decided to have a crack at it. Anyway, I'm going to essentially take my husband's true crime podcast virginity. He's never even listened to one, and I'm making him do one with me. He's got no idea who I'm going to talk to him about. I can say things like, last night, I said to him, oh, we should do JonBenet Ramsey, and he said, who's that? Yeah. So you are going to get to enjoy all his first-time reactions firsthand. We've got a complete newbie on our hands, and it's my mission to basically gross him out as much as possible.
Good luck. Yeah, honestly, good luck.
So I actually picked our first deviant. And just to give you a quick overview, a deviant is anybody who basically acts in a way or sort of has behaviours outside of the societal or culturally accepted norm. So it can be murder, rape, theft, arson, sort of anything basically that makes you a dick. I've chosen this one today because when you first discovered many, 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 many moons ago that I had an interest in true crime, specifically serial killers, you very proudly told me that there was a serial killer where you grew up in Crawley.
Oh.
So today we are covering the acid bath murderer, John George Haig.
Played by Martin Clunes.
I know, he's so creepy! Do you remember Men Behaving Badly?
Yeah.
And I remember watching that, and watching him things like Doc Martin, where he's this like sweet, nice sort of gentleman doctor, or this derpy guy in the 80s that I suppose it was the closest thing that we had to friends in the UK. And then I made the mistake
of... Bit of a different palette, I'd
yes,
say.
Yes, well, obviously. We're British. No sex, please. But I remember watching that kind of stuff as a kid. And while I was doing my research, I opened up YouTube to have a little look at A is for Acid, which is the film that he did.
Mm-hmm. It's the most... Which I got you.
Yes, it's the most sinister fucking... Have you seen it?
Yeah. Well, sure, it was on TV.
Like, how big does that smile get with that dicky little moustache?
Oh, no, it could get bigger.
He's I'm sure really works creepy. On it. I mean, you'll find out later on, like, honestly, in a lot of ways, it was absolutely perfect because John George Haig is really, really creepy. But it just ruined my childhood memories. It really did.
So I can only remember him as Martin Clunes, the acid bath murderer.
Oh, well, there you go. So you do know a little bit about this one, then.
Yeah, because I used to live in Crawley, so there would be times where I'd be out and about, like, cycling places, and I looked down a road and be like, oh, I wonder if he lived down there.
Oh, do you not know where he was?
Not a clue.
Oh, well, I do. I checked.
Crawley's a bit of a ramshackle of a town. It's a various little areas that sprouted up and kind of merged together.
Well, it's a commuter town, isn't it? For London. So...
Yeah, and it's where the protagonists of Assassin's Creed Unity were born.
There you go. Yeah. Well, as I say, I actually looked up his location in Crawley versus the road that you grew up in, and I know exactly where it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I will show you later.
As in, was it near?
It was so near.
Really?
You grew up in Stafford Road, didn't you?
Yeah.
It was very near.
Nice. Then I was way off where I was going. I wonder if we live down here.
Oh yeah, you were completely off. We've gone past it, I'll tell you that much.
Cool.
We've gone past it.
Ah.
So, anyway, I'm going to go through my hours and hours and hours of research and regale you basically with just what a fuckwit he really was and how he was utterly disgusting and what dreadful things he did to his poor, poor victims.
But then he got caught.
Thank God. John George Haig.
Martin Clunes.
John George Haig.
Mark.
Focus.
Yeah.
The acid bath murderer.
Yeah.
Was born on the 24th of July 1909 to parent John Robert Haig, who was an engineer in the mining industry, and his wife Emily, who was a homemaker. Something you find quite a lot looking at these old cases. Nobody really cares about what the women are up to. I couldn't find anything about her.
Well, I'm sure they were proud.
She didn't kill anybody, so that's a start.
Yeah.
Now, an interesting thing is that John Sr. and Emily were actually members of the Plymouth Brethren, and they raised their son in a really strict environment. Do you know what the Plymouth Brethren are?
I think they are a brethren in Plymouth, and that's all I
Actually,
know.
they started in Ireland.
Fucking lying.
We used to have a community of them actually where I grew up in Surrey, and all the little girls would come to school wearing blue headscarf coverings, and they all have very, very long hair. They weren't supposed to cut their hair in sort of fashionable styles or anything like that. I don't know if you've ever seen them. And the older women would be sort of, I think it's probably, and this is coming from a complete point of ignorance, it's probably the closest thing that Britain has to the Amish community.
Huh.
I don't know if you've ever seen.
No, no.
No, okay. Well, I did some reading because I'm a good girl. The Plymouth Brethren are a devout fundamentalist Christian movement who believe that the Bible is the highest form of authority over any other, including common law, if it contradicts the Bible's teachings. Their members are expected to avoid any form of sin. It's really, really strict. So there's lots of different offshoots of the Brethren. It's not just one community. The restrictions on their lifestyles vary from group to group. So the stuff that I'm talking about right now, it doesn't necessarily speak for all members. I don't want anyone to come for me. But basically, in Haig's family and what they followed, they weren't allowed any entertainment of any kind. So no music, no magazines,
Did they have
no
electricity?
books. Yeah, they had electricity,
Oh, lavish.
but they were not allowed any kind of secular entertainment of any sort. They were only allowed stories from the Bible. They also weren't allowed to play any sports at all. They didn't celebrate Christmas, and little John Haig was not allowed to play with any children outside of the Brethren community. It's very, very insular.
So if they didn't celebrate Christmas, then we know why he went crazy then.
Well,
it wasn't the fact that he didn't have Christmas, it was the fact that he never had Christmas
it's
dinner.
a sweeping generalisation. Lots of people don't celebrate Christmas.
No, you need your turkey. You need your turkey.
I don't know if they ate turkey in the tens.
Well,
it might have been goose at that point.
It was a crazy time.
This upbringing resulted in a very isolated childhood for Haig.
Not surprised.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, he wasn't allowed any contact basically with anybody outside of the Brethren community, which is fairly common as I understand it. Again, if I'm wrong, please don't come for me. I did my best.
Or even better, if we are wrong, you happen to be in this community.
Yeah, please let us know.
Correct us.
Yep, I'm always willing to take corrections. I am very, very good at being wrong. So yeah, he had a very isolated childhood. And it may have, as you suggested, affected his emotional development and his social interactions with others later on in life. On top of this, his parents were very much keen on the idea of hell as punishment, and they threatened their small child with it regularly for basic childhood mistakes, indiscretions, accidents such as bedwetting. He would be threatened with hell if he didn't stop. So it wasn't an ideal start to life for John Haig. Just to make it clear, I'm not blaming the Plymouth Brethren for anything that he became. You know, there are lots of people who live in that lifestyle, turn out to be perfectly nice and normal and don't stuff people into barrels and melt them in acid.
Yeah.
It's just, unfortunately, on this particular occasion, it might have been a contributing factor,
yeah.
If we're completely honest.
Yeah, should have introduced him to hobbies other than murder.
Like model painting.
Well, yeah, that's
something
a good
nice
one.
And wholesome for little boys.
Yeah.
But it might have been one of those things, as we say, that may have contributed to his psychological profile as a whole in later life.
His neurological errors.
404 finally found.
404 humanity not found.
Haig was actually extremely bright, which is something that you do see in quite a lot of psychopaths. They tend to have very high intelligence.
Oh, yeah. No one would call Hannibal Lecter an idiot, would they?
He's not real, but no. He was an intellectual.
Don't lie to me like that. Yeah, he was.
By the age of 10, he'd become a virtuoso piano player. It's one of the few things that his parents allowed him to do, and he was playing at a master level. This actually won him a scholarship to the very prestigious, I can't say that word.
Prestigious.
Prestigious, thank you.
Prestidious.
Prestigious. Do you know how hard that is to do with, like, even the tiniest little lisp that I have?
It's a prestigious amount of
prestigious. It was a really good school.
Top level.
Top level. It was the Queen Elizabeth Grammar School, and he was actually also accepted to Wakefield Cathedral as a choir boy.
Ah.
So he looked like butter wouldn't melt in his mouth.
Yeah, I can definitely see Martin Clunes as a choir boy.
I'm going to have to put a picture of him up on the Instagram. I'll add it in after the episode goes up so you can see just how creepy he is.
Martin Clunes?
Yeah. He's so disturbing. Despite his strict upbringing, Haig still managed to get into mischief as a child. His teachers at school would refer to him as secretive and devious. From a young age, Haig figured out that he could actually forge his teacher's handwriting and signatures on both documents and letters home to his parents. And he used that to create all sorts of trouble at school. On top of that, he was also a terrible pickpocket and thief. He would steal from teachers, from other students. He became very, very good very, very quickly at taking what did not belong to him.
So with the, I keep thinking them as Mennonites, the
Plymouth Brethren.
Yeah, how does that work with the school? Was that
well, this is what I thought as well. And apparently his parents gave him a little bit of leniency with the music and were kind of were prepared to look the other way with that. And that then led to his education. And I guess like any parent, they wanted a higher quality of education for him than what they could necessarily provide. So they just kind of looked the other way, apparently.
Okay.
But they were absolutely horrible to him about other things, to the point where he used to have all sorts of awful nightmares about burning in hell and things like that. So it doesn't really make up for it, but I think they, you know, the best intentions pave the way to hell and all that.
Yeah, it does.
So, yeah. I don't think they had any ill intentions for him. It was the only life that they knew. I think, unfortunately, as I say, it just combined with something else in him that was broken, and he turned out to be a nutter.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit. Everything that he learned at school, both legal and otherwise, helped him develop his skills as a con man in his later life. At 17, he left school, and for a time he was apprenticed to a motor engineer. He learned all about cars there, which was really handy for him, because that helped in his fraud career later on as well. And at the age of 21, he was sacked from the motor engineering firm, again due to suspicions of stealing.
See, just knowing what he'd go on to do, I can just picture him standing in a garage, like just patting a wrench in his hand, looking at a barrel, thinking, I could do something with that.
Ah, see, that's really interesting that you've had that mental image of him. Because that's not what he was like at all.
No?
He was incredibly suave and smooth and charming. He really was. There were pictures of him when he was young, and honestly, he looks like a film star.
Hmm.
He was incredibly smooth, which is kind of what all con men need to be, really.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be good at what you do. But yeah, he could talk the knickers off a nun. He was really, really, really charming. So it's, yeah, it's funny that that's what popped into it. But maybe okay. That's because you know how the story ends.
Yeah, and because I've been playing a lot of Hitman and knocking people out of wrenches.
So you're, what's the word? You're transferring.
Yeah.
I'm locked in a house with this man.
Hello.
During this time, while he was working at the motor engineering company, he also became more aware of the world outside of the Plymouth Brethren community. And he started to meet and develop a fascination with the upper classes of the British sort of social societies via his job. And he'd never been exposed to that kind of wealth or access before. It was just something that didn't happen in his upbringing. When he became aware of it and he started to meet these people and see the lifestyles that they lived, he became very, very envious. He was really coveting their wealth and their lifestyle. And he decided that he wanted to be part of that world by any means necessary. First of all, as I say, he refined his physical appearance. He used to spend his wages on very, very sharp suits. His hair was always very neatly brill creamed to the side. And yeah, as I say, as a young man, before he turned into a complete and total monster, he was very, very good looking. He did look like he'd just stepped out of a Rita Hayworth movie.
Who?
Rita Hayworth. She was an actress in the 30s. Have you seen Shawshank Redemption?
A long ass time ago.
She's the woman that Andy Dufresne has on his poster over the tunnel.
Oh. I know, yeah, I know.
Famous that... 30s movie star.
Were you going to say MILF then?
MILF?
Famous 30s MILF.
She may have been a MILF.
Oh, we'll Google that later.
Okay. Memo to yourself, check how Rita Hayworth aged. So all of this was to make himself as attractive to these upper class people as possible. He wanted to try and look the part and start to fit in with them.
Well, that's just general con man stuff, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, look the part, pretend the parts.
Look what you the part you want to play.
Snake yourself into the part.
Mm-hmm, so you can assimilate. So this was all very, very carefully constructed by him. It was very, very effective. He could, as I say, absolutely charm the pants off of anybody. In his own words, I discovered there were easier ways of making a living than working in an office. I didn't ask myself if what I was doing was right or wrong. That seemed to be irrelevant. I merely said that this is what I wish to do. So fuck you, I don't care if it hurts you or upsets you. I want this, I'm going to make it happen, I don't care. It's not very nice.
No, a little bit of a narcissist, you reckon?
Yeah, there's probably a fair amount of narcissism in there.
Just a tad.
So in 1934, Haig married 21-year-old Beatrice Betty Hamer. She was a former model and waitress. She was beautiful, actually. I feel really sorry for her. It's thought that he didn't actually love her at all. He married her so that he could get out of the Plymouth Brethren community, and also so he could look normal. And again, if you're playing serial killer bingo, you find that's something that can come up quite often. There will be serial killers who commit the most heinous, atrocious crimes, and they will have a wife and family at home who have no idea, and they're able to basically compartmentalise their personalities and live two completely separate lives and appear to be a loving husband, a loving father, and then go in at night and tie people up and dangle them from copper pipes and bash their heads in.
Dangle them from copper pipes and bash their heads in.
Whatever springs to mind. Yeah. No specific references, but...
And also, serial killer bingo card coming in episode 10.
You want me to make an actual bingo card?
Yeah.
Okay, I can do that. We can play serial killer bingo.
I can sit and tick them off as we do the episodes.
Note yourself, make bingo cards.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's two things to research now.
So at the same time as he married Betty, he started his first really big con. And kind of... funny, if you're not a victim of it. If this is where he'd stopped, it would have been like, oh, you roguish scamp, and gone on my merry way. But he didn't stop here. So what he did was, he set up a used car business, selling off cars, providing all the documentation with them. They were all fairly high value, nice sort of sports vehicles and things like that. None of the cars belonged to him.
Wait, did he nick them or...?
He forged documents for them. He took people to the cars, where they were parked, in their locations, said, this is your vehicle now, took their money, and turned it off his merry way.
What about the keys?
People are stupid.
They'd be like...
I'm not victim blaming, I'm not. No, he was very good at what he did.
Well, hang on a sec. If someone takes you down a road to some random car parked outside a bloody two-bedroom bungalow and says, right, here's your car, give me the money. All right, they say, we've got the keys. I'll be right back. And an hour later, he's not back. You're going to think, I think we've been had.
You know, this was the 30s. People were very innocent.
There's got to be a point where you think, hang on a second.
Well, there was actually, to be fair, because although I personally find this quite amusing, the people that he victimised didn't. And
no.
He did get arrested. And he did get sent to prison.
So someone did notice then.
Yes, and it didn't take them very long at all. Literally 4 months after he married Betty, he was convicted of fraud and he was sent away to prison for 21 months.
I can see how that happened as well. I'd be like, all right, have you got the keys? No, I'm going to get them. I'll come with you. Ah, shit. Run away!
a surprise, honestly.
Then Martin Clune sprinting down the road while some bloke tackles him, while his wife's in the back going, go on, love, get him, the bastard.
I wouldn't be surprised, in all honesty. I can't imagine that people were very happy about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he did get sent to prison. And poor Betty, bless her, actually had a lucky escape, because the moment he was arrested, she set about filing divorce papers. She divorced him. She was pregnant at the time, and she actually gave birth to a baby girl and gave her up for adoption. She didn't want anything to do with him or all the terrible things that he'd apparently done. His family obviously were very, very conservative and very strict, and they also completely disowned him at this point. So he was cut off from everything he had known, because when you leave the Primeth Brethren or you're cast out, there is no contact with the community whatsoever at that point. It's like you don't exist, you're dead to them. Huh. So they just dropped him like a stone. Can't say he didn't completely deserve a degree.
I think he kind of had a hand in his own kind of downfall.
Yes, absolutely. If you commit a crime, then you deal with the consequences.
Yeah.
But at the same time, at that point, he wasn't physically hurting anybody. He was just taking advantage of people with more money than sense.
But
again, I'm not victim blaming. Well, he was a prick.
The Plymouth thing has a very strict no sin thing, and
yes,
thou shalt not steal,
mm-hmm,
or iron or copper.
You're punny.
I am very punny.
So yeah, first time inside, lost absolutely everything as a result. When he came out, it seemed like for a little while he did actually attempt to go straight for the first time in his life. And he set up a dry cleaning business with a partner that actually was doing really well. And it looked like that everything was going to work out for John Hague, and he was going to be able to get his life back on track. He was making a legitimate living. And then the gods of irony struck again. And unfortunately, his business partner died in a car crash. So at that point, John George Hague couldn't afford to run the business on his own. It collapsed and he was left completely destitute and back at square one. And he decided at this stage, I'm completely unable to make a normal, reasonable living. So I'm going to try another tactic.
I'm going to be an asshole.
Mm-hmm. Following this collapse of his business, Hague moved to London in 1936. He was looking for greener pastures there, essentially, just starting over. He managed to get a job with a young man called William McSwam, who was fairly wealthy in his own right, and he owned a series of amusement arcades. Literally like ping pong machines and things like that.
Yeah, mostly ping pong machines back in those days, I dare imagine.
Oh, is this your field of expertise, of course, isn't it?
Well, that they're going to have Pac-Man.
I don't know. I was surprised to see that they had amusement arcades at all in the 30s.
Yeah, it was probably mostly pinball machines and the malt shakes.
Those little things that you push the pennies in and it pushes a bunch more down.
I mean, most of Brighton Pier.
I used to be obsessed with those when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I used to stand there with fistfuls of 2p's and my poor grandmother going, you're wasting your time. And I'm like, just one more, it's nearly there, just one more. You don't realise how quickly you can go through a couple of quid in 2p's.
Yeah, I can see that.
I was very easily entertained.
What year was this?
Oh, God, I must have been about 5 or 6.
No, they all paid.
1936.
Okay. Yeah, it probably was mostly pinball.
As you say, they didn't have Pac-Man, but it was all they had, and it was very, very successful.
Yeah.
William did really well for himself. John basically got a job with him, first of all, maintaining the machines that he had. And later on, he became William's personal driver. And William, bless him, didn't have a lot of friends, or really any friends. And John became his first friend. Now, to give you some context on why William didn't have any friends, he was the same as John Hague in that he was raised in a very religious environment, but it wasn't the Plymouth Brethren. His family were Presbyterians. Basically, it's another form of Christianity. And they just believe in really humble living, and again, kind of avoiding sin, but not in any extreme sense, just in frugality, humility, don't be a dick. A good motto for anyone to live by. William was his parents' only child, and they were very, very close because they didn't do things like go out dancing or go out in society. They spent all of their time pretty much exclusively with each other, just the three of them. And although William was an entrepreneur and doing very well in his own right with his businesses, he was known to be very, very shy, very, very timid and withdrawn. He was incredibly sweet-natured and just really the perfect kind of prey for somebody like Haig. Haig was actually only working for the McSwan family for a brief time, and then he went to prison again.
For what?
This time for a different fraud scheme that he was running at the same time as while he was working for the McSwans. He set up a fake solicitor's firm. So what he did was he registered 3 fake offices throughout the southeast in the name of William Cato Adamson. So they were meant to be 1 office in Surrey and 2 in Sussex. He then had all his professional stationery and letterheads printed with the branding and the offices' addresses on and made it all look really, really plush, like the equivalent of Beer Building, basically a quick slapdash, flashy looking website now.
Mm-hmm.
He then started taking out adverts in the local papers around the 3 supposed offices' addresses, stating that he was dealing with a deceased client's estate who had no next of kin, and so he was selling off shares of the estates for a price below the average in the market. And of course, people started writing in, going, oh my god, this deal is too good to be true. Quick hint, if you ever think that, it probably is.
Yeah.
John would then write back to them on his very flashy stationery and tell them all about the prices of the stocks and shares and what was available. And if they just sent him a cheque, he would transfer the ownership over to them. So people started posting cheques to him.
So it's like the original, you've won 200 million Ugandan dollars.
Yeah, it's like a Nigerian. It's like a
Nigerian prince.
Yeah.
Yep.
But way before his time. It was mail fraud. But people did send him money, and he lived quite comfortably for a little while off the checks that people were sending him, until one of his potential targets was clever enough to catch him out. The way that he caught him was when he received this very flashy-looking letter from the supposed solicitor's office. He noted that the office address, which was the Surrey one, based in Guildford had been misspelled. He missed out the D.
So Guildford.
Guildford, yes. For any of our international listeners who can't tell from the horribly nasal Queen's English accent.
Queen's English.
Guildford is a cathedral city, if you can really call it that, in the southeast of English. In the southeast of England. That has, this is the most I've spoken in months because I haven't seen anybody.
Yeah.
So Guildford is a cathedral city in the southeast of England that actually has a silent D in the name, because why should we spell something phonetically?
Yep.
So it's spelt Guildford.
Unless you're doing mail fraud.
Unless you're doing mail fraud.
Yeah.
And then you miss out the D.
Yeah.
Which was enough to raise suspicion. John George Haig was promptly sent back to prison.
Huh. And as a small note on Guildford, The 2 times I've been there properly, I played Laser Quest.
That's exciting.
Yep, that's all I have on Guildford.
My mum has a brick with her name on it in Guildford Cathedral.
Huh.
When they were building
it. Throw it through the window?
No, when they were building it, they ran out of money to finish the spire. So what they did was you could pay £1 to buy a brick, and it would be inscribed with your name, and they used that to finish it off. So my grandparents bought one for each of the children.
Nice.
So my mum's got Caroline up there on the cathedral spire.
Awesome.
Random fact for you.
Ah.
That's one I bring out at parties.
So I've been to Guildford without the D to play Laser Quest 2, and your family is permanently embedded in the cathedral there.
Absolutely.
Okay, I think you'll win.
I win.
Yeah.
So Haig was in and out of prison a lot over the next few years, every single time for fraud, theft and forgery. He was a frequent flyer at Her Majesty's pleasure. And while he was in prison, Haig unfortunately learned several new things, both from his fellow convicts and the prison's own libraries. So one of the things that he learned from his fellow prisoners was that leaving victims of his crimes alive was leaving witnesses to aid in his prosecution, which unfortunately is a lesson that a lot of repeat offenders learn in prison. Nobody can accuse you if they're not around to do it.
And also how to make a prison shank after the prison.
A plastic cup.
Or a plastic cup.
Plastic cup's quite a common one. Because they're not allowed ceramic for their tea and things like that. So they've got plastic cups. And if you shatter it, you get quite a good shard out of it. I can't remember. Oh, it was Mythbusters. I watched an episode of Mythbusters where they made crossbows in prison out of paper to test a myth. And they went to a prison and they went
through... shooting inmates.
No! They went to a prison and the officers there actually had a little museum of all the shanks that they'd taken off of prisoners. There was some really nasty stuff. Oh. There was another one that was a slingshot made out of underwear from the elastic of made out of the elastic from somebody's underwear.
Nice, and this is what Martin Clunes learned.
Hmm?
This is what Martin Clunes learned while in prison.
He Haig learned much worse things.
Ah.
Much worse things. The next thing that he learned about was the French murderer, and I'm going to absolutely
butcher the pronunciation,
but I'm going to try in my very English voice. Georges Alexandre Sarret.
Georges Alexandre Sarret.
He was a French murderer in 1925 that used sulfuric acid to dispose of his victims. And the third thing that he learned about while he was in prison was a Latin phrase, corpus delicti, which literally translates to body of evidence. The only problem was he misunderstood what a body of evidence was. What do you think it is?
He took it very literal, didn't he?
He did.
There's a body, this is evidence.
I did. So a corpus delicti actually refers to the evidence, either forensic or circumstantial, that is collated in order to prove that a crime occurred. Haig thought that it meant literally the dead body that was the victim of the murderer. So if there was no body, he could not possibly be accused of murder. And he genuinely believed that.
So he took it very literally.
He took it very, very literally.
So when someone said to him, oh, it's raining cats and dogs outside, I'd be like, oh, I hope they're okay.
Well, I suppose it just goes to show that however clever he thought he was still a bit dim.
Yeah.
He was still a bit dim. Can't give the man too much credit.
No.
Haig swore to himself that once he got out of prison, he would never go back. While incarcerated in HMP Lincoln, Haig managed to get work in the tinsmith factory there, where they actually used quantities of sulfuric acid as part of the tin processing. So he began to steal small quantities of the acid from the workshop. God knows how he got away with it. I would not want to put that on my ass.
Just walks out of it in his mouth.
I don't know how he got it out. Can you imagine if you, like, secreted that somewhere upon your person?
Could have been a metal thermos.
That would be horrible. Well, no, because it's not like you'd be allowed something like... I don't know. He managed it. I don't know how, but he did. He then also started bribing his fellow prisoners with tobacco to bring him any bodies of dead mice that they found on their work placements or within the prison. And he used these mice to work out his formula for how much sulfuric acid he needed to completely dissolve a body. So in his cell, he literally had rows of jars. Again, I don't know how he got away with this. I don't know who was doing the contraband searches. But he had rows of jars of dead mice in various volumes of sulfuric acid. And he got it down to such a fine art with his calculations that he could melt a mouse completely in 30 minutes.
Huh. So the person doing the cell checks, was it like a blind paraplegic or something?
I don't know.
How could you miss that?
What's
in those jars full of slowly decaying matter? It's from Woodshop.
I'm making candles. I'm making soap from scraps.
Yeah.
Ignore
that one's still squeaking.
We all know that there's corruption in the prison system. It may be that he bribed and smooth-talked and worked his way around. I don't know. But he did this in his cell. And he wasn't exactly subtle about it.
No.
From his experiments with the mice, once he got it down to that precision of 30 minutes, He was then able to work out how many litres of acid he would need to dissolve an average human being, which is 120 litres, according to him. Just to give you a little science, kind of to help understand how nasty sulfuric acid is, the pH scale is a numbered scale from 0 to 14 that measures the acidity or alkalinity of a substance.
Yep.
So water is considered completely neutral.
Seven,
yep. Exactly. It's completely neutral on the pH scale. It's bang in the middle. It's completely harmless to humans unless somebody holds your head under it. But you can drink it or you can rub it on yourself and it's all good. Anything with a pH of 8 and above is considered an alkaloid.
Mm-hmm.
And anything with a pH below 7 is an acid.
Mm-hmm.
The lower the number on the pH scale, the more acidic a substance is, and the more aggressive the reaction will be if it comes into contact with a human. So to kind of give you a comparison, human stomach acid, which is hydrochloric acid, has a pH of between 1.5 and 3.5, depending on things like your gut health, your diet, blah, 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 blah.
And if you've got heartburn or not.
Yeah, that will all affect, that literally affects yep. the pH of your stomach. Now, the human stomach acid can eat through bone, through metal, through certain types of stone, and has a pH of 1.5 to 3.5, which is actually, when you think about it, really impressive that your stomach can contain that.
Mm-hmm.
And also does explain just why heartburn is so fucking painful when it happens.
Yeah.
In comparison, sulfuric acid has a pH of between 0 and 2. That depends on where you buy it from, because it's so violent and so aggressively reactionary with other substances that a lot of the time will be sold kind of watered down into a solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's normally sold at about 98% potency, which is what I think from what I was reading that Haig used. And at 98% potency, it has a pH of 0.3, so it's very, very, very nasty stuff, and it was his new favorite toy. As well, just to give you an idea, if you put a chicken thigh in 2 liters of sulfuric acid, it will be cooked, inverted commas, within 5 minutes. It will be half the size within 2 hours, and it will be completely liquidated within 24 hours.
That's a waste of chicken.
It is a waste of chicken. And it also, can you imagine how gross that must be?
Yeah.
Like just watching it disintegrate. I don't want to do that.
Advice for the listeners, if you want to cook chicken thigh, don't use acid.
Don't use acid.
Use
no.
oven and various herbs and spices and stuff.
Or cook it in Coca-Cola.
Or cook it in Coca-Cola,
that was so
yeah.
yummy.
That was nice.
It's not weird. It's yummy. Try it.
Yeah. Cola chicken. Anyway.
When Haig was released from his most recent stint in prison in 1944, he returned to London and he rented the first of what would become 2 very famous properties later on.
So, hang on a sec.
Yeah.
So, he gets let out of the prison.
Uh-huh.
And they're do I take these jars with you? Or should we leave them for the next inmate? Like, what?
I don't know if they had parole then. I honestly don't know. There were so many ball drops in this.
Yeah.
So many ball drops. It gets so much worse.
I just walk into his cell. He's standing there with a mason jar with acid in it. And he's dangling a dead mouse. And they're like, oh, yeah, there you are. We're letting you out because you've done your time and we don't think there's any reason to keep you here. And he's like, oh, excellent. Drops the mouse, seals the jar, puts it on the window ledge. Out he goes. No fucking questions asked.
But yeah, basically.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But this is what happens. People go to prison for relatively minor crimes, and some of them learn to be better criminals.
Yeah, and sometimes the stuff you learn isn't particularly good.
No.
Like the inmates tried to give themselves coronavirus by sharing a mask.
Oh, that was disgusting.
They're stupid.
Were they sniffing it or licking it?
They were, I don't know, probably.
It was so gross.
And none of them got coronavirus.
There's this...
And the wardens were like, you're fucking stupid. You're not getting out.
So gross. Well, no, it wasn't it that they did get coronavirus, but it was basically really, really minor. And they were like, fuck you, you're staying here.
Yeah, the bottom line is that the wardens were like, you're staying there.
You're idiots.
You're fucking stupid. But you stay in there.
It was just, can you imagine, like, sniffing in somebody else's loogie?
Ugh.
Like, how desperate do you have to be to do that? I've just got mental images now of, like, doing lines of loogie up the nose. Trying to get coronavirus.
Just See, you say that, but you get squicky when I had the Jackass movie on there.
Oh, it's disgusting. But my head is a safe place. Nobody else is allowed in there. So, Haig, as I say, in 1944, when he was released from Lincoln Prison, went back to London and rented what would be one of two very famous properties in the future, which was 79 Gloucester Road. And only a month later, by some horrible stroke of luck, Haig actually bumped back into William McSwan, the man he had worked for when he was fixing the arcade machines and he'd been driver for.
The chauffeur, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He literally bumped into him in a pub in Kensington High Street. It was called the Old Goat, and it was just the stars of absolute horribleness aligning. William was really pleased to see him because he had no idea about Haig's criminal career. He was completely in the dark and was absolutely delighted that his friends just popped out of nowhere, bought him a pint, made a nice long chat.
How did he not?
He didn't know.
He went to prison whilst working for him.
Yeah, he had no idea.
How long was he away for?
4 years. Maybe longer.
He's away for 4 years.
Might have been longer, actually. I think it's been nearly 7 years since they've seen each other.
He bumps into him in London. And he's like, Martin Clunes. I've not seen you for 4 years after you mysteriously disappeared.
Seven years.
Whilst you're maybe working for me.
He had no idea.
And there was
all
the stuff in the newspaper about you scamming people. Where'd you go?
Oh, I guess it wasn't in the newspaper. He had no... Don't forget how isolated William was.
Yeah, but surely someone would have come around the arcade and said, oh, that bloke you used to work with.
No. Nope. They had no idea.
Bloody hell.
Many, many ball drops.
Yeah, but he got no toes left at this point. It just shattered
awful.
Them with the barest balls they dropped.
But this is what con men do. They are so good at covering their tracks. William had no idea he'd been in prison. He was just genuinely glad to see him and very, very eager to rekindle the friendship because Haig was really his only friend outside of his parents. So they started spending a lot of time together. And while Haig had been out in and out of prison, William had just become more successful. He'd become very wealthy. He got his portfolio of properties with his family that he managed. He actually personally went out and collected the rents. And when Haig was spending time with them, he started to go along for these little trips and seeing how much money was exchanging hands. And at that point, I think pound signs just popped up in his eyes. He really pushed to reforge this friendship with William. He was spending time with him every single day. And William was so trusting and so happy to have him back in his life. He actually introduced him to his parents, who, as I say, were total introverts up until that point. They didn't have any real friends either. So he's got these three incredibly vulnerable people that he's just winning over left, right and centre. They have no basis for comparison with this guy. They're so naive. Haig slowly permeated every part of William's life and business dealings. He began regularly visiting the whole family. He'd do things like take tea with them or go overnight. He was almost like another child to the McSwan parents. And he was very, very patient, waiting for an opportunity to strike. This went on for months. And he was just observing and recording and looking for a window of opportunity. Unfortunately, this was wartime Britain. It was 1944. And so that meant that the opportunity did eventually present itself. Again, it was just a series of events that seemed to slot into place so perfectly for this total utter bastard. William McSwan was due to be conscripted into the British Army after the D-Day landings, although we were having success. I say we, although the Allied forces were having success pushing across Europe, there'd been a lot of losses, they were running out of men, so conscription laws were changed and they were pulling anybody that they could. William's mother, Amy, obviously didn't want her son to go to war, was absolutely desperate to hide him. She had nowhere else to turn, and so she asked for John George Haig's help to make William disappear and avoid the draft, and William very happily agreed to do that.
Did he make the body of evidence disappear?
He made him disappear, all right.
Oh, dear. He takes things very literal, doesn't he?
Well, he was just waiting for something like this to come up. Such a scumbag. And she trusts him so much. Ugh, gross. On the 6th of September 1944, John George Haig lured William McSwan to the property that he rented at 79 Gloucester Road on the pretense that he had a business venture he would like to partner with him on. This was a low-profile opportunity that wouldn't attract a lot of attention, but would bring William a steady income while he was avoiding the draft. William had no reason not to trust him and went completely willingly to the property. This was a basement property at the bottom of a flight of, I think, three flats. It was one of those big townhouses in the middle of a terrace. There was shops and everything all around it. It wasn't subtle.
So it's like the one in the TV movie.
It's been a very long time since I've seen the film, but yeah.
Yeah.
It was basically down a flight of steps. You had what looked like a door to a flat outside. You opened it up and there was a basement in three compartments.
So like most of Brighton, you got the flats going up and there's always the one that's down.
Yeah, basically.
And it was always dirty and...
It's London, so basically everything just expanded up once they ran out of room sideways.
Yeah.
And then it expanded down.
Yeah.
He lures William to this property with the promise that he can help keeping him financially stable and take him off of the army's radar, but still keep him in a comfortable living situation. When he gets him into the basement, Haig proceeds to bash his vulnerable friend over the head with what he called a cosh. He can't actually remember what the murder weapon was. A cosh can be anything from a lead pipe to a stick to a table leg. It's a large, heavy object that causes massive blunt force injury. And it took William 5 full minutes to die because Haig was shit at what he did, basically. He couldn't even make a good job of it. He bashed his poor, vulnerable friend who trusted him implicitly and who must have felt so betrayed over the head, watched him drop to the floor. There would have been massive swelling in his brain. He could have had seizures. He probably had difficulty breathing. But he would have been conscious, aware of what was happening to him and who did it. And it took him 5 minutes to die. It was horrific. It's disgusting.
Yeah, that's just thinking. It's like,
can you imagine what must have been going through his head? He was so naive and so trusting. Once William was dead, Haig didn't actually deal with the body straight away. He left his victim on the floor of the basement.
Went out for McDonald's.
I know. He went home and went to bed and slept very well, according to his interviews with police. He then had a nice lie-in the following morning, rolled out of bed about 11 o'clock, went out shopping, had a leisurely brunch, and stopped off at a car showroom to do some window shopping and imagine what he was going to buy with William's money. He's vile.
Yeah.
He's vile. When he eventually returned to 79 Gloucester Road, Haig proceeded to set about the matter of disposing of William's body.
The body of evidence!
He's such an idiot. So, this is horrible. He stripped William down naked, stole all his clothing and his valuables, which were his first profits from murder. He was only 5'8" tall, Haig, but somehow he managed to pick William up, who was over 6 foot. He was a big guy. He was thin, but he was tall. And 5'8" Haig managed to pick him up and somehow stuff him into a 3-foot-high water butt that he'd stolen from a nearby bomb site. He must have been incredibly strong, despite his size, to be able to do that. Think about, oh, it's horrible to even think about, but compressing a human body into a 3-foot space.
I've not tried it, to be honest.
Oh.
Not yet, at least.
I bet things won't crunch.
Well, yeah, but he slept perfectly fine after murdering his only friend. So I'm sure he would have been, push it down, snap, pop. It was like, oh, fuck's sake,
this
William.
Is a purely practical thing to him. He has no emotion about this whatsoever. He doesn't think of this, of William as a person. He's a cash machine.
Yeah.
He stuffed him into this water butt. He then donned a rubber apron and rubber gloves, and he began to pour sulfuric acid that he'd been stockpiling by setting up a shell corporation to order industrial quantities. He took this and he poured it over William's body in the butt. Now, he was actually really underprepared for this one. It was his first murder. He didn't know what he was doing. And again, you see this with serial killers over time. They perfect their methods. They figure out their MO. They get better at what they do, which is a really unfortunate way to describe it, but I can't think of any other.
Trial and error.
Yeah, they refine what they do, but at this point he really, really sucked at it. And what he didn't expect was when he poured the acid into the butt, because it was such a big body, and because there's so much more fat tissue on a human as opposed to a mouse, it produces a much more violent reaction, and the acid actually began to boil around William's body and began to pour off loads of poisonous smoke and was filling up the basement. So Haig decides, fuck it, and just walks out and leaves. And just leaves this boiling acid filled with his dead friend in the bottom of the flat and goes off for 2 days and goes on his merry way.
He was thinking about cars at the time.
Yeah, he was very distracted. He returned home after the weekend and went to check on the barrel. The chemical reaction had finished. When he opened it up, he described what looked like a red porridge substance in the bottom of the barrel that gave off a foul smell.
I'd imagine so.
That used to be a person. He used to be a really sweet person. So just to add insult to injury, he poured all that was left of William McSwan down a manhole in the basement and then cleaned out the drum, removing all trace of his victim from the earth. No remains of William McSwan would ever be found. He was completely gone, which is so sad.
And for reference sake as well, this was a similar technique that was used in Breaking Bad, but instead of pouring them down the sewers, they buried the barrels in deserts.
Well, presumably this is where the Breaking Bad got the idea from.
Well, I dare say, like, this kind of thing happens.
Yeah. Did they use sulfuric acid in Breaking Bad? I must be one of the only people on the planet who's never watched it.
Can't remember.
Because the whole thing was, didn't it, like, not melt the bathtub?
Yeah, that's because Jesse cut corners.
Oh.
Because he was sent to go and get a tub to melt the body in. And he was like, yo, I've got a bath at home. And he puts the body in the acid in the bath.
No.
And unsurprisingly, that ends up in the hallway.
You have to use special plastics.
Yeah.
That don't react.
Yeah, just.
I'm stupid and even I know that.
Yeah.
Meth is a hell of a drug.
What?
Jesse's on meth, isn't he?
Yeah, he wasn't at the time, though.
No? Not... He was just a derp.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never seen Breaking Bad.
He failed chemistry.
This is knowledge by osmosis.
Yeah.
I know nothing about Breaking Bad. I'm so not cultured.
Magnets.
Magnets.
Yeah.
Isn't that a Bill Nye joke? I don't
what?
Know. I'm British. I know nothing.
I'm British. I am limited in my intellect.
I have a very small world that I live in.
Yeah, it's a lockdown. The world consists of this bungalow and nowhere beyond.
I know, and our pillow fort. Well, sorry, blanket fort.
Yeah. Oh, well, actually, no, tell a lie. For you, the world consists of this bungalow, the road between here and Hobbycraft.
Yeah.
And
occasionally Tesco's.
Oh, living it up.
Occasionally Tesco's.
Yeah, which is a few shops down from Hobbycraft, so it's still kind of the same.
Might need to do a beer run later.
All right.
Once Haig had finished disposing of William McSwan's body, he described a sense of euphoria. He had committed the perfect crime as far as he was concerned. He had killed his first victim and got away with it, and now he could collect.
I can understand the euphoria, because he was testing this process.
Yeah,
he'd
been plotting this for years.
And then
hold that thought, because that's important later.
Okay.
He'd been testing this for ages. And it worked.
Does this come up in the test later?
No, but it will give you another opportunity to call him a massive cunt.
Oh, I've not done that though.
You will.
Okay.
By the end, you will. He is a cunt. Haig was such a bastard that the next thing he did was visit William's parents, Amy and Donald, and he told them that he had helped their son escape to Scotland so that he could go into hiding and avoid conscription.
This was one of the better things he could have said.
Oh, yeah. Just what? As Amy had asked him. So, of course, they naturally believed him because they'd asked him for his help. And they were so grateful that they gave him William's old job collecting rent from their tenants. They were so thankful that he'd saved their son. This guy's despicable. Haig also used his forgery skills to begin acquiring William's money and possessions. He forged letters from William to his parents, saying that he was alive, well, and happy in Scotland, and he sent them fucking postcards, like he was on holiday. And he could imitate his handwriting and his signature perfectly. They completely believed him.
His mentions like, oh yeah, I'm in Scotland, the weather's great, it's nice and sunny. Hang on a second.
That's what kept
him away. There's no sun in Scotland.
I'm going to get all the Scottish people really angry now.
Like, oi, we know it's right, but... we know that winter takes up 3/4 of the year.
Listen, my parents live on the west of the Scottish Peninsula, and they were very proud of the fact it got up to 21 degrees.
Yeah.
Despite his successful thefts of William's belongings after his death, Haig wasn't satisfied because he found out after he'd murdered his friend that none of the properties he'd managed were in William's name. The deeds were actually in Donald McSwan, his father's name. So Haig hadn't gotten everything he'd wanted out of this murder. His greed was absolutely insatiable, and he decided that he had to act again. He'd already gotten away with one murder. His plan had worked perfectly. His methods were sound as far as he was concerned. So what would a couple more be? It was nothing to him at this point.
Well, his method wasn't sound because he's nearly smoked himself out of the house.
Look at his ego, though. He's convinced that he's an evil genius. He's so far up his own arse. Haig decided to bide his time. He continued his relationship with Amy and Donald McSwan, who obviously were missing their son dreadfully and probably saw Haig as something of a stand-in and sort of a foster child to them at this point. They brought him into their lives that much. And Haig was able to learn the full ins and out of all their property deeds, who their solicitors were. He learned to imitate their handwriting again, and just set up doing exactly the same thing as he had done to William. So on the 2nd of July 1945, Haig capitalised on his scheme of maintaining the illusion that William was still alive and lured his father Donald to 79 Gloucester Road by telling him that his son had unexpectedly returned from Scotland to visit with them. Donald was so thrilled, he went with Haig as willingly as his son had to the basement property there. Haig had learned much from his previous experience with William. This time he had prepared much more meticulously. His weapon of choice was an iron bar, and once again he beat Donald savagely over the head. When he was dead, he stripped him and stuffed him into one of two waiting oil drums that were neatly placed side by side in the basement. Only an hour after he murdered Donald, he then lured Amy to the basement under exactly the same pretense that William was there waiting for her, beat her with the same pipe that he had used to kill her husband, and again forced her body into the waiting second barrel. Haig then donned the protective equipment that has become synonymous with the image of the acid bath killer. Rubber gloves to the elbow, a rubber raincoat, thigh wader boots, a leather butcher's apron, which I found particularly gross because that's also what Jack the Ripper was supposed to wear, and a wartime gas mask. He covered both bodies with acid, dissolving them side by side, and just as with their son, once they were gone, he poured the liquid remains down the drain. Haig wiped out the entire McSwan family, and not a single trace of the three of them was ever found. And they must have realised, well, I mean, you can only hope it was quick, but if it wasn't, they must have realised that he'd done the same thing to William. Haig then set about obtaining the McSwan's assets in their entirety. He sent forged letters from Amy and Donald to their associates, claiming they'd emigrated to America, having mastered their handwriting and signatures. He transferred all of the properties from Donald's name to his own, sold them off, and liquidated every asset he could, even gaining access to Donald's pension. Altogether, he acquired about £8,000. I've checked the inflation on this because I was like, that's not a lot of money for a human life. It comes out to about £280,000 today. I still don't think that's a lot for a human life, like for one, let alone three.
That was a lot of liquidation.
It's just, it just shows again how little he values other people.
Mm.
280 grand for three dead bodies. He's so short-sighted. Because the McSwans had only really kept one another's company, sadly, nobody suspected anything that had happened to them, and they were never reported missing. They just vanished off the face of the earth, and people accepted what Haig told them. With his new ill-gotten fortune, Haig moved into the Onslow Court Hotel in Kensington. It was a high-end hotel offering long-term residences in one of the most affluent parts of London. He slotted in easily with the hotel's usual clientele, largely wealthy women of an older age. Haig's charm was in full force among them, joining various other residents for meals and drinks to sniff out potential future marks. He told people he was the liaison officer for a large engineering firm he called Union Engineering Group. This is the same shell corporation that he'd used in order to order his sulfuric acid. And he spent the money he'd acquired from the McSwans lavishly on clothing, dinners, sports cars, as well as racking up gambling debts. He went through the money as if it were water, and by 1947, the equivalent of nearly £300,000 was gone. In 2 years, he'd spent the lot.
Well, that was silly.
How do you go through that much money?
I could show you.
Like, an exciting life to me is buying brand name baked beans.
Well, how much was it again?
280 grand.
280 grand.
You couldn't buy a house for that now, fair enough, but
yeah, I could do that. I could do that in an afternoon.
I physically, it'd be like Brewster's Millions, just throwing money everywhere to get rid of it. Haig wasn't worried though. He developed a solution to his financial problems now. He had a formula that worked. Take from other people and make sure to take everything that they have.
Liquidate their assets and then liquidate their assets.
I know. I've just made that mental leap. Liquidate. Oh!
Double liquidation.
Oh, God, that's gross. Haig began looking for a new target. Again, he was searching for a wealthy victim and refining his MO. Rather than go back to the basement at Gloucester Road, he found a small workshop at 2 Leopold Road in Crawley. So, do you know where that is?
There rings a bell.
I've looked it up. You know the Sainsbury's?
The one with the home base?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's like a sports centre there as well. And then you've got Ifill Road.
That's the long one, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you come out of Stafford Road, where you grow up.
Yeah.
You go straight down Ifield Road for a mile and for just over, like, yeah, 1.4 miles.
Yep.
You take a right and Leopold Road is there. It's a 30-minute walk.
I'm getting on Google Maps.
We've gone past it when you took me to see where you grew up. It was that close.
That's right by the hospital.
Yeah. I ran it through Google Maps yesterday and I was like, oh, it's not there anymore. They knocked it all down. It was there. It probably was there when you lived there. When did you move into Stafford Road?
Of existence.
So the building was probably still there when you were a toddler. Huh. I think they knocked it down in 1996.
Yeah.
So you may have gone past it. I'll show you a picture later and you can see if you can recognise it. But it was that close to your house.
I wouldn't recognise it, I can tell you that.
No? You don't remember weird things like that. You're not like me. You're not a monster.
No.
But it was that close. So when you said you lived by a serial killer, I was like, oh, he's somewhere in the general county. No, he was, you know, 25 minutes away.
Yep.
2 minutes by car.
Yep.
The workshop at Leopold Road was in the corner of a builder's yard, filled with scrap materials and surrounded by a high wooden fence, offering much more privacy than his previous location. Haig then saw an ad in the paper for a house that was for sale by a couple, Dr. Archibald Archie Henderson and his wife, Rosalie Rose Henderson. Archie was a medical doctor born in Glasgow in July 1987 to a wealthy family. His father was a banker, his mother a housewife. The family were social members of Glasgow's upper class. He was educated at the prestigious Grammar High School of Glasgow and after being conscripted to serve in World War I, he graduated from Glasgow University in 1929 as a medical doctor. Rose was his second wife. She had actually been his mistress during his first marriage before his first wife, Dorothy, had passed away. So he wasn't squeaky clean.
So he had a backup plan.
Yeah, he did have a backup plan. I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but from what I was reading, he was kind of a dick. And I will put links in the show notes to my sources so that if you want to read more about this case, you can do. I don't want to get bashing the victims. He wasn't the nicest man in the world.
He just had a backup wife.
Yeah, doesn't mean he deserved to die, though. Rose was 10 years his junior, a woman with a nervous disposition who likely suffered undiagnosed depression and anxiety. She frequently fell ill with nerves and was known to take to her bed for days at a time. She was born the 11th of September 1907 and had something of a tumultuous childhood, with her father being convicted of bigamy when she was 3 and frequent moves across England to try and find her father work as a dentist and then a chemist. She was well educated, speaking multiple languages, and graduating from Pitman's College London as a skilled secretary, so much so that at one point she was actually employed by a firm in New York's Equitable Building. This was a huge building in the financial sector on Broadway, and it was actually the biggest skyscraper in the world at the time, so she was doing very, very well for herself.
Nice.
So, yeah, she wasn't an idiot.
No.
She was just, you know, these days everybody's got depression and anxiety. I've got depression and anxiety, you know.
Yeah.
It was just back then they didn't know how to treat it. It didn't mean that there was anything wrong with you as such. It just meant that she had off days.
Yeah.
Mental diabetes. Archie was also Rose's second marriage, and their affair had begun when she was also with her first husband. So, yeah. It wasn't the ideal start to a relationship.
No.
They weren't perfect people. I think often when people are dead, you have a tendency to kind of canonise them. But this is just the facts of the case. They weren't perfect people. They loved each other. They made some poor decisions. Doesn't mean they deserve to be murdered. The Henderson marriage began happily, but was also known to be passionate in both positive and negative ways. Both husband and wife were heavy drinkers, and it was suspected that Archie and Rose were both abusing prescription medication that Archie was acquiring for them via his medical degree. The pair could be enamoured with each other 1 minute and fight viciously the next. They were very much water and oil, as it sounds like. But they did love each other. They also lived very extravagantly. They were known to throw lavish parties, spending enormous amounts of money on jewellery, clothing and socialising at dinners and clubs. After World War II, they began investing in properties in and around London, building up a portfolio of private and commercial rentals, and this was how they attracted Haig's attention. The Hendersons were looking to sell one of their properties in August of 1947 in Ladbroke Square, London. Again, this was a very, very wealthy area of the city. I don't know if it's what the Ladbroke bookies named after. I wouldn't be surprised.
I have no clue.
And neither have I. I didn't bother to look it up. It just popped into my brain just now.
Well, apparently a lot of gambling places were like originally made as fronts for organised crime. So
that wouldn't surprise me. They're money laundering.
Yeah.
The fact that the house was being sold in such a wealthy area of the city caught Haig's eye, and he contacted the Hendersons, basically buttering them up by offering them well over the asking price and telling them that they had undervalued the property. Of course, he didn't actually have the money to buy the house. He was completely skinny. He was overdrawn. He was destitute. He was well behind on the payments at the hotel. He didn't have 2p's to rub together.
Con man's got a con, though.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole point was that he didn't want to buy the house. He was never intending to. So the deal fell through, but to him that didn't matter in the slightest, because what was important to him was making contact with the Hendersons, and it completely worked. Even after the house sale fell through, he remained their friend. And carefully over the following 5 months, he cultured a relationship with them around things like a shared love of music and the finer things in life. He used his ruse of being a successful engineer to help enter their social circle. He was a frequent visitor to their home again. I just find it so creepy that he's in their houses. So creepy. He would actually play piano for Rose at some parties she'd held, she would hire him as his musician.
Because he was a virtuoso, wasn't he?
Exactly. So it's just everything about him is just stuff that he uses to get to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I hate people like this. I find him absolutely repulsive. On one of these occasions, then, when he was invited to their home, he found that Archie still had his service revolver from when he was in the war. So he decided to just steal it.
Yep, because he was a tea leaf.
He was an absolute tea leaf. And again, that gun will become important later on. So the Hendersons had grown fond enough of Haig that in February of 1948, they even invited him to join them on holiday in the seaside town of Brighton, which is near here, and it used to be dead posh, and it's not anymore. I quite like Brighton, but there are bits of it that are rough AF.
Yeah.
Rough AF. So, White Hawk?
Shy Hawk.
Yeah, White Hawk's the kind of place where you don't go unless you're 6'5" and weigh 300 pounds.
Yeah.
It's rough.
I've worked with a lot of people, I've worked in a lot of jobs in and around Brighton, and I've worked with a lot of people that have at some point lived in White Hawk, and no one has ever had anything good to say about it, unless, of course, you're, like, football hooliganism. And
I used to get the bus through there when I came back from work, when I worked in Brighton City, and the 12 would go through White Hawk and stop at the Lidl's for, like, 15 minutes where they did the driver changeover, and literally my arsehole would just clacker shut every time I was there. Every time somebody got the bus at the stop, I'd be like, please don't shift me, please don't shift me.
Yeah, so it's a great place.
Yeah, I don't miss doing that.
No.
But this wasn't the part of Brighton that they were visiting. This was back when it was genteel and all in candy colours and all that sort of thing.
Yep.
Haig joined Archie and Rose on the trip, but he would be the only one to return. On the 12th of February 1948, while in Brighton, Rose had fallen ill and had gone to bed. Not wanting to waste the day, Haig offered to drive Archie to his workshop in Leopold Road to show him an invention, inverted commas, he had been working on that the Henders might be interested in as a joint business venture. Archie was known to be interested in gadgets and toys, so much so that he actually owned a doll hospital toy shop, which I think is so fucking wholesome, as one of his many properties, and he happily went with Haig to see this supposed invention. There wasn't one, of course, and when Haig had the doctor in his workshop, he shot him in the back of the head with Archie Henderson's own gun.
Well, I'm sure it's a lot better than having your head caved in for 5 minutes straight.
Well, this is the thing as well. It's quite interesting that he switches murder weapon, because this guy, in a lot of ways, is quite atypical to other serial killers. Normally, once they find something that works, they stick with it. I think, again, because this was all about money and getting it as cleanly and quickly as possible, he got no pleasure, I don't think, from the killing whatsoever. It had no emotional impact on him. So when he found a better way to do it by stealing Archie's gun, he made that leap.
Well, his process was more okay. It wasn't a case of, I'm going to get them down to this basement and kill them. It was a case of, I'm going to get them down to this basement, get them in the barrels.
Yeah, he just wanted them not to exist.
Yeah, so it's more efficient that way.
Yeah.
Just walk them in, bang, into the barrel.
It's just something that I find really interesting, because I have quite an obsession with serial killers from the 70s. And for them, their MO and their ritual, it's all sort of psychosexual and blah, 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 blah. But for this guy, it's completely practical.
Yeah, there's steps that he has to achieve
mm-hmm.
to get what he wants.
Once Archie was dead, he again stripped him naked, as he had with his other victims, stealing his valuables, including a gold cigarette case. A gold cigarette case. I'm just going to leave that in, because you have no idea how many other stumbles I've edited out at this point. So he stole a gold cigarette case and a pocket watch. He then placed him in a waiting oil drum and covered him with sulfuric acid. Haig drove back to Brighton the same day and told Rose that her husband had fallen ill. She must return to Crawley with him immediately. Rose sadly believed Haig. Why would she not?
And you'll never guess what happens next.
Yeah, I know. It's just, he does it over and over again. He keeps getting away with it.
Let me guess. He took her there, shot her in the back of the head, popped her in the barrel?
after he'd finished stealing her clothes and her jewellery. Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Huh.
He executed her with her husband's gun, stuffed her in the barrel next to her husband. Then he put
different
the lids
barrel.
On. Yeah, no, two yeah. barrels side by yeah. side, marital bed.
Were they the same barrels he'd done the parents in?
I have no idea. Oh, that's a really horrible thought. It probably was.
Look, he said he washed out
yeah,
the first
one, didn't
he?
Yeah, he cleaned them out. Oh, that's horrible.
Efficiency. He's about efficiency.
He is about... Oh, I can't believe you're... It worries me that your mind went there.
What? It is, though.
That's horrible.
You mentioned that he cleaned them out.
He does.
He has two barrels from killing the guy's parents.
He does.
So it makes sense
and
for him
actually,
to...
actually, yeah, when because when they find him, when they catch him eventually, he's got these two corroded barrels in the workshop. So, yeah, he's reusing the same barrels. Oh!
There you go.
Oh, that's horrible.
You're welcome. Are you glad you brought me on for this?
No. Right. So after, that's going to haunt me. Thank you.
That's all right.
Oh, just to add to his dickheadishness, once he put the lids on the barrels containing Archie and Rose, he then went back and finished his holiday for the weekend.
Yeah.
He's such a dick.
He's got a routine. Mm-hmm. He has things planned out. And plus, it's given the image of normality as well.
Yeah.
Because then he's going back, doing what he was doing.
It just, he has no fucks to give. I can't imagine that, just being that untouched by the violence. 2 days later, Haig returned to Leopold Road to find an issue he'd not considered previously. Unlike the basement property at Gloucester Road, the workshop in Crawley didn't have a drain inside it. This meant that he had to move the barrels and risk being caught. But by now, Haig had gotten away with murder 3 times and he felt invincible. Without any concern at all, he wheeled the barrels out into the yard where the builder's scrap pile were, and he simply poured the sludge that used to be Archie and Rose out into the yard. Can you just imagine how much that must have stank?
Just imagine some yard foreman standing there smoking a pipe, watching him. It's like, yeah, it's like, yes, don't mind me.
But that's the other thing. He wasn't alone. This was a shared property. He was renting it from a removals company.
Just pouring this viscous red mud.
Yeah.
Like, what's that? Paint chips.
Seems legit.
Porridge. People porridge.
It's raspberry flavour.
Yeah, do you want some?
I mean, I'm very fortunate in that I've never smelt a dead body, but I have smelt our bin after I've left a smoked mackerel packet in it on a hot day.
Wow.
And I have to imagine it's worse than that. But yeah, he honestly has no fucks to give. He dumps them essentially in the front garden. He's so up his own ass. He's so cocky and so confident. He's just like, whatever, whatever, I do what I want.
Well, who's going to make the connection of man's... pouring stinky red stuff down the drain too. He's killed someone and put them in acid.
To be fair, fair enough. Who would have thought that? It's such a heinous thing to do.
Well, you wouldn't get away with that nowadays just on the fact that you'd get the old environmental health waiver.
Well, yeah, and also because now they're really interested in the sewers because of COVID, aren't they? They reckon they can find it in poo.
Really?
Yeah, have you not seen that?
No.
It's one of the new track and trace systems that they're looking at. They're testing poo.
Huh.
It's a glamorous job, isn't it?
We couldn't find any COVID, but we found...
sweet corn!
We found sweet corn, wolf hair and bits of an old credit card.
Oh, I've just had another horrible thought.
What?
You know, like, you get fat bugs when people pour cooking oil and stuff down the drain. Do you think that's people bugs?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, because no. It was the fat that didn't dissolve. Ugh. I'm not going to sleep tonight. I'm definitely not going to be able to eat spaghetti bolognese for a couple of days.
For listeners that are curious, Google fatbergs. Enjoy!
Just as he had with the McSwans, Haig employed his forgery skills to begin liquidating the Henderson's assets. He sent letters to their families and business associates claiming to be from the couple and told everyone that they had decided to emigrate to South Africa. He even persuaded Rose's brother with his lies. He sold off all of their properties and possessions, right down to their clothing, and pocketed the profits. Once again, he amassed the equivalent of around £250,000 in today's money, and his expensive lifestyle was funded once more. Haig's plans had worked again. But he hadn't learned anything from his previous squandering of the McSwans' money. In fact, this time with the Hendersons' fortune, he was even worse, continuing to live at the Onslow Court Hotel and spending at an alarming rate. He made several poor investments, continued collecting sports cars, and amassing massive gambling debts. Within just 1 year this time, the money had run out, and Haig once again decided he needed a new victim to make a cash withdrawal from. Living in the Onslow, Haig had his pick of wealthy, vulnerable widows and took his time vetting potential victims. He would schmooze them using his charm and good looks to gain their trust and gather knowledge about their financial worth. Eventually, Haig settled on his sixth and final confirmed victim, Mrs. Henrietta Helen Olivia Roberts Duran Deacon, known as Olive. I love this woman. She is a fucking badass. I had to go digging to find some stuff about her, but once I did, I was so pleased. Little is known of Olive's early life. She was born in Richmond, Surrey, on the 28th of February 1880 to a middle-class family, her father a successful solicitor. She had several siblings, and the family would later relocate to Twickenham, becoming part of London's social society. Around 1906, Olive became involved in women's suffrage, and over the next few years, she was known to actively protest and heckle politicians. She also became involved in more violent protest action, helping to smash over 100 shop windows in Regent Street, which she was arrested for. She was given 12 months probation at her hearing when she refused to promise the judge not to commit further offences as part of the suffrage movement in the future. In 1918, Olive married Major Reginald William John Duran Deacon. You can tell these people come from money, their names. Mm. He was a career soldier who continued active service until 1920. When he was discharged, he became a successful partner in a solicitor's firm in London. The couple lived very comfortable lives and were actively involved in political and social society, regularly attending sponsored events and dinners. The pair were well-liked and very happy within their marriage. With no children, when Olive's husband died in January of 1938, he left everything to his wife, which was around £500,000 in today's money. Olive was devastated by the loss of her husband. She turned to religion for comfort, so much so that she had a book of prayers that she had written published. She also left the home that she'd shared with Reginald, and in July of 1942, she moved into the Onslow Court Hotel to live her remaining life in comfort there. Haig was drawn to Olive like a moth to the flame. She had no immediate family, and through sensible investments from her husband's estate, she had accumulated over £36,000 in personal fortune in 1949. That today would be a value of around £1.3 million.
That's many coins.
It was many coins. And she dressed very, very beautifully. She wore lots of very expensive gold and pearl jewellery, and it was like a big neon sign over her head, basically, that says, "I've got money!" And John George Haig just focused completely on her.
I've got acid!
You're horrid! Unfortunately, Olive was also known at the hotel to be relatively lonely, and her trusting, generous nature made her an ideal mark for Haig. He wormed his way into Olive's confidence, joining her for dinner at the Onslow and regaling her with tales of his success as an engineer and inventor. This sparked Olive's interest because she'd come up with a unique idea and was looking for a way to put it into production. Olive had come up with the idea of making plastic artificial nails that could be sold in the cosmetics industry. The woman was clearly brilliant because she'd actually come up with this idea 5 years before press-on plastic nails were invented in 1954. So she would have been minted if she'd have been alive. She would have been absolutely minted. She was so ahead of her time.
Mm.
It's such a shame. Haig convinced Olive that he could produce the nails for her and invited her to his workshop to look at business plans. On the 18th of February 1949, Haig drove Olive to the workshop at Leopold Street. As with all the other victims, there were no business plans waiting. He shot the 69-year-old woman in the back of the head, stripped her of her clothing and jewellery, including a very valuable Persian lamb fur coat, then stopped for a break to walk down to a local cafe and enjoy a plate of poached eggs on toast while she was on the basement floor.
No. That's the second time he's just...
He just wanders off mid-murder to go and have something to eat.
Yeah, why not?
And it wasn't a basement floor, sorry, it was the workshop floor. He had a leisurely meal, making friendly chat with the proprietor of the cafe, and once he'd finished eating, he later returned to the workshop, placing Olive in the barrel of acid. 3 days later, he returned to pour her remains once again out in the yard outside his workshop. Haig no longer had any fear. Finally, though, he had made a mistake, and Olive Durand Deacon would be his undoing with the help of her close friend, Constance Lane, who I also love. Constance Lane was another resident at the Onslow Court, and unlike the McSwans and the Hendersons previously, she noticed very quickly that Olive was missing. On the 19th of February 1949, the day after Olive had disappeared, Constance approached Haig, questioning him about where Olive was. This woman was in her 70s and she's like, "Oi, fuckhead!
Are you?"
She would not be ignored. It was awesome. Constance had never liked Haig, finding him greasy and insincere, and she knew that Olive had had an appointment away from the Onslow with him the previous day. Haig insisted that Olive had never turned up and that he had no idea where she was. Not to be put off, Constance then informed him that she would just be going to the Chelsea police to report Olive missing. Haig offered to drive her himself and he took her down to the police station. He is so arrogant. Your face right now.
It's just like, I'm going to go to the police. Fine, I'll take you there myself. Okay.
After Constance's report, the police visited Haig at the Onslow several times to take statements. He maintained his story that Olive had not made their meeting. One officer noted, though, that the 39-year-old dapper Haig seemed very out of place among the Onslow's almost entirely elderly, female, widowed residents. Another officer, after the third interview, Sergeant Alexandra Lamborn, stated in her report that Haig had made her feel very uneasy, appearing far too eager to please and seem helpful to police. She suggested that Haig's background be investigated further, and on checks, the police found Haig's lengthy criminal history of fraud and theft. He immediately became their prime suspect in Olive's disappearance. They learned of the property he was renting at 2 Leopold Road, and on the 26th of February 1949, after obtaining the landlord's permission, Detective Sergeant Pat Heslin and his colleagues forced entry into the workshop. At first glance, it all seemed fairly innocuous, but as the police conducted their search, they began to uncover reams of evidence, including the following: a revolver and accompanying bullets, rubber work gloves, a leather apron damaged by chemicals, a wartime gas mask, empty acid containers, corroded metal drums, and a handbag containing a receipt from a dry cleaner's in Reigate for one Persian lamb fur coat. Police immediately went to collect the coats from the cleaners, and on confirmation that it was Mrs. Durand Deacon's, they once again brought Haig in for question. So what he'd done is he decided that he liked this coat so much that he was going to have it cleaned. The coat that she was wearing when he killed her, he was going to have it cleaned before he pawned it off or perhaps gave it to a girlfriend. And he brought the ticket back to the warehouse.
He takes this lambskin Persian coat.
It's a very, very expensive piece of fur.
Into a dry cleaner's. Mm-hmm. And it's like, "Hey, I've got a bit of blood and grey matter on this. Would you clean it for me?"
Uh-huh.
"Certainly, sir. No questions here."
Uh-huh. And then he brought the receipt home.
Did nobody ask any questions back then? Apart from Olive's...
Constance.
Apart from Constance.
She's not
the only person asking bloody questions.
She's the only person, and she's about 3 inches tall and weighs about 16 pounds. She's tiny, and she's absolutely fearless. I love her.
It's like one bloody Zoolander. Am I taking fucking crazy pills here? she's in a room of oblivious people.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
Are you glad you agreed to this?
You think someone would, like, stop and think for a minute.
You think someone would give a fuck.
Yeah.
Constance did.
Yeah.
If it weren't for Constance, he just would have carried on, honestly. He would not have stopped.
She's the only person that put, like, two and two together.
Yeah.
And got four, where everyone else is coming up with fucking B.
Just getting, "Oh, that Johnny, he's a bit of a rogue, but he's all right, really."
Oh, yeah, he's a barrel of laughs, he is.
John George Haig was so cocky at this point, he actually fell asleep in the police station waiting to be interviewed. However, the questioning officer, DI Albert Webb informed him that Olive's coat had been located due to the receipt in Haig's workshop. And to the officer's surprise, Haig began to freely confess, but not just to Olive's murder. This is where the misunderstanding of corpus delicti comes in.
Okay.
He was so convinced that due to corpus delicti, he could not be charged with murder without the presence of a body. He began to proudly tell the police about the murders of the Hendersons and the McSwans in great detail. He was so pleased with himself and his own genius at how he had gone around about committing the murders and cover-ups. He said to Detective Inspector Albert Webb, "Mrs. Joanne Deacon no longer exists. She has disappeared completely, and no trace of her can ever be found again. I have destroyed her with acid. You will find the sludge that remains at Leopold Road. Every trace of her body is gone." He literally couldn't shut up. Fortunately, he was also wrong.
Yeah.
Knowing that they needed help to gather enough evidence to prove murder, police brought in one of Britain's leading forensic pathologists at the time, Professor Keith Simpson. He actually quoted, he was so good at what he did that he would consult with Scotland Yard, and he was one of the people that helped bring the craze to justice. This guy was hardcore.
Okay.
At Leopold Road, Simpson first of all found multiple bloodstains inside the workshop that matched Olive Duran Deacon's blood type. Then on his search outside, Simpson found a small, fat-covered stone that turned out to be an intact gallstone the acid hadn't eaten through. And it takes months for acid to eat through gallstones. They're deposits from the liver, I think calcium, I could be wrong. If there's any doctors listening, please correct me. But they basically gather in the bile duct, in the gallbladder, and they cause horrible, horrible pain, and it's from a rich diet and things like that. But they are so compact and so tightly packed with minerals, it takes months for them to dissolve in acid. But Haig was too much of a moron to realise that. And also probably didn't know that Mrs.
had a gallstone.
Had gallstones.
Yeah. It's not like you open them up to check.
No. This gallstone really encouraged Simpson, and the police intensified their search in the yard outside the workshop. Over the next week, they found the following: 28 pounds of undissolved human body fat, 3 gallstones, part of a human left foot, 18 fragments of human bone, a full set of dentures confirmed to belong to Mrs. Duran Deacon by her dentist, the handle of a red plastic handbag, and a lipstick container. Haig had wrongly believed that the sulfuric acid would obliterate everything, but in fact he had left an enormous body of evidence to prove the committal of a murder, which is the true meaning of corpus delicti. Haig was arrested, charged with murder, and remanded into custody at Horsham County Police Station.
He really misunderstood that, didn't he?
He really did. He thought he was so clever.
There's no body, so you can't get me. This makes you think of the guy that called the police and said, "If I send your floppy disk, can you track it?"
Oh, BT no. Kelly. Yeah. We'll cover him later.
Yeah, it's just...
We'll cover him later. Because he's an absolute shit stain and he deserves to be mocked.
But it's this idea, the people that think they're like that far above the police, but they're actually a few rungs below because they don't fucking process things properly. Like corpus delicti.
Thank God he was, though. Because as I say, that's stupid.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wouldn't have stopped, as I say. It's a compulsion.
Well, it was down to the one person with Constance.
Mm-hmm.
Down to Constance that goes his undoing.
She's a baller. Haig's arrest caused an absolute sensation. Papers were full of garish headlines about the mass murderer of Crawley and his workshop of death, further fuelled by Haig entering an insanity plea in April of 1949.
I know about this one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Haig claimed that he was driven by bloodlust and a need to consume blood, that he killed to drink from his victims, and for a while the media ate it up, dubbing him the vampire killer. Is that what you knew?
Yep. He put a puncture... He told the people that he put puncture wounds in their necks to drink their blood.
It was bullshit.
Yeah.
It was total bullshit.
You're trying to play madman to get off of being yeeted from this plane of existence?
There was no evidence that Haig had ever had any interest in blood or the consummation of it, or insanguinated... exsanguinated, this is what I get for using big words, anyone. This was just his only option for a defence tactic. There was such overwhelming evidence of his crimes that his only chance of avoiding the hangman's noose was to be found insane. During his interviews with police prior to entering his plea, Haig actually said to Detective Inspector Albert Wells, "Tell me frankly, what are the chances of anyone being released from Broadmoor?" Do you know what Broadmoor is?
Broadmoor's that one out in the... When we went past it?
Yes! When we were on holiday.
And I shouted out the window, "Ha, you got caught."
There were two people who were escaped at that time when we were there.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. They were on the moors.
Ah.
And we stood there feeding ponies.
Yep.
Just like, "Ah, that's fine." Shadow of Broadmoor in the background.
Yep.
Two of them running loose.
Yep.
So for those of you who don't know, Broadmoor is a very high security psychiatric hospital in Britain. And it's such high security that people often mistake it for being a prison. It isn't, though. It is a hospital. It's focused on therapeutic care.
It is?
Yeah. It's a hospital.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
It's focused on therapeutic care and rehabilitation. And there is a chance of being released from Broadmoor on the completion of successful treatment.
See, now I'm just thinking that my dad's ever had to go there for work. I'm glad
you qualified that. I'm just thinking if my dad's ever had to go there.
I know, for the listeners, my dad's, before he retired, he used to fix machines in hospitals.
Probably not, because it's a psychiatric hospital. I don't know how much. I mean, they would have an infirmary,
If they had a rust machine, then he would have gone there.
He's
been to Trinidad.
And see if you can get him to record it, and then we can always play his tales from Broadmoor for our listeners.
Tales from Broadmoor.
Yeah, Broadmoor is a hospital. It's not a prison.
Huh.
And that's
it just looks like a prison.
It does. Everyone, it's extremely high security.
And everyone refers to it as a prison.
But it's not a prison. And that's why Haig was asking, because he was hoping to get found insane, be sent to Broadmoor, and after maybe 10 years, be released. He thought he could get away with murder this way. Haig had several psychiatric evaluations on the run-up to his trial, and it was found that while he probably did suffer from some form of mental illness, the amount of premeditation and the lengths that he went to try and cover up his crimes were clear indicators that he was absolutely not insane. He understood right from wrong. He knew what he was doing.
And you can't really give someone a mental illness diagnosis of being a fucking asshole.
That's a shame. It'd be nice if you could.
Yeah. So, what's the diagnosis, doctor? You're a fucking asshole.
You're a dick.
In my professional opinion, you're a piece of shit.
Just a red stamp on the top of the file.
On the fucking forehead.
Dick.
Asshole.
On July 18th, 1949, at Lewis Crown Court, Haig's trial began, presided over by a Mr. Justice Humphreys. Public interest in the case was huge, with some 4,000 people crowding outside of the court to try and get a glimpse of Haig. Of course, there's no TV at this point, don't forget.
Yeah.
So if they, you know, if you're a true crime buff.
So didn't have podcasts, just had a book club.
So just had a camp outside at Lewis.
Yeah, just read the newspapers, wait to see what kind of psycho is going to be out there.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, being a psychopath with an enormous ego, Haig absolutely loved the publicity. And there are lots of photographs of him being led to and from the court by police, grinning ear to ear. I will put these on the Instagram. They are so disturbing. He looks like he might be going off for a day at the fair.
Well, we watched, I can't remember, that long-named thing about Bundy.
Oh, extremely wicked, shockingly evil and vile.
Yeah, that one. That really easy to remember series of words.
It's a quote from the judge.
He was all happy.
Oh, he loved it.
Yeah.
He absolutely loved it. And Haig's exactly the same.
Yeah, exactly.
They eat, and it is that narcissism thing. They absolutely eat up the attention. He felt like a celebrity, which is all he ever wanted. All he ever wanted was to be flashy and important. Yep. And this is how he got it.
Mm-hmm.
So these photos, honestly, looks like the cat that got the cream. It's disgusting. To the outside world, it was hard to equate the horrific crimes with the small, 5'8", immaculately dressed and groomed man that the police were leading into the courtroom. The trial only lasted 3 days, during which 33 witnesses were called to testify. The defence team stuck... Sorry, I can't help but laugh at this. The defence team stuck with their insanity plea, not denying that he committed the murders, but claiming that he was so ill he did not understand the depravity of his act. In contrast, the prosecution carefully laid out the evidence of a highly sophisticated and intelligent organised killer who'd stalked his victims for months, brutally murdered them, and then meticulously covered up his crimes with a repeated method that he would refine. Haig, meanwhile, was so unmoved by the events of his trial that while he was in the court and the prosecution were making their case, he sat there doing crossword puddles.
He's a bit confident, isn't he?
He's a scumbag. He just has no fucks to give. He's awful. It's fine, though, because fortunately the jury are not idiots. And on the third day when they are dismissed to go and deliberate and work out a verdict, it takes them 15 minutes to find Haig guilty, which I think is probably just enough time to sit down and have a cup of tea.
Well, just 15 minutes sitting there going, my God, you're such a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
So son of a bitch, done it.
Sat out there going, right, well, we have to leave the courtroom. We can't just sit there and go guilty. Ethel, do you need a whisk? I love it. 15 minutes. I saw some articles that said 13. It was literally, they went for a waz and they came back and convicted him.
Well, one of them was sitting there banging his head against the desk going, why the fuck am I here? Mm-hmm. This is so sure. Of course you did.
When Haig was brought back for sentencing, Justice Humphreys donned his black cap and asked Haig if he had anything to say for himself before his sentence was dealt. Haig's only reply was, nothing at all. Justice Humphreys sentenced Haig to death, because yes, at one point we did have the death penalty in the UK. It wasn't actually abolished until 1965. So Haig was remanded into custody at Wandsworth Prison until the 10th of August 1949, where at 9 a.m. he was hung from the neck until dead. In a last disturbing display of ego, prior to his death, Haig had broken an agreement with Madame Tussaud's Wax Museum that his likeness should be displayed in their Chamber of Horrors. He arranged a death mask to be taken after his execution and also donated his favourite suit and tie to the museum, quote, so that his likeness could be as true as possible to real life. Personally, all I can say is fuck him.
Huh.
He was a monster and he's been immortalised in the museum. It's still there.
Chamber of Twats.
Mm-hmm. So, as far as I'm concerned, he shouldn't be honoured for his crimes. He revelled in all the attention that they gave him. We shouldn't be focused on him. It should be about his victims. So, again, just to remind you of each of their names, they were William McSwan, Donald McSwan, Amy McSwan, Archibald Henderson, Rose Henderson, Olive Durand Deacon. And just a final note as well, although it was never substantiated, Haig actually claimed to have killed 3 other people. And that was a young man named Max, a nameless young woman from Eastbourne, and a nameless woman from Hammersmith. He may just have been bullshitting. You see that quite a lot with serial killers. They were claimed to kill more people than they have. But at the same time, given his methods and the fact that he dissolved the bodies in acid and poured them down the drain, it may well be true.
Yeah.
There's no way of knowing.
And he had 2 different places he done it from as well.
He did. And he may have had more. He was a complete nomad. We just don't know. So it's important to just acknowledge them because there is a chance that he did do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that he definitely killed those 6. And he's an absolute fucked hard. And all I can say is I hope that they are all resting in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the story of the acid bath killer, John George Haig.
Played by Martin Clunes.
Seriously, if you want to lose sleep, go and watch A is for Acid. You could probably find it on Prime.
Which I got you on DVD for Christmas.
Yeah.
You're delighted.
I love the Christmas presents you buy me. So, Stuff has arranged a little something to lighten the mood for you before we go. This is something that we're going to do at the end of every episode, because obviously the subject matter that we're covering is really heavy and can leave a really nasty taste in the mouth. Staff has taken the task of providing you with something just to brighten your day in the world of true crime before we close the episode out. So, Staff, over to you.
Okay, so, derpy criminals?
Derpy criminals.
What comes to mind when I tell you about the Lufkin Liquor?
Nothing that I could say on air, probably.
The Lufkin Liquor was a woman that, with a friend filming, or probably filming herself, went into a supermarket, got a half gallon of Bluebell tin roof ice cream, which the company describes as a vanilla ice cream with a rich chocolate fudge swirl and roasted peanuts dipped in dark chocolate.
Yum.
She opened the lid and licked it. A lot. Contaminating the fuck out of it. Now, bear in mind...
Just in the middle of the shop?
Yeah, in the middle of the shop. Okay, and people wonder how COVID spread so quick.
Oh.
Got people like this, idiot. So, the local police, the Lufkin Police Department, they nicked her in the Bluebell licking case. We did not intend to pursue charges against her as an adult, and therefore what happens from here is at the discretion of the juvenile justice system. Yeah, it was definitely a malicious act. Bluebell, the ice cream company, said, yeah, don't fucking do that. It's fucking disgusting. And it got millions of views on her, was it Instagram? It's got 11 million views on her Twitter video. There you go. Just goes to the supermarket, licks a big old tub of ice cream, gets arrested, but 11 million views. Okay, so if you were to watch that, this fucking weirdo going in, licking ice cream, putting it back on the shop because she's fucking disgusting and having no sense of hygiene, would you then think, you know what, I want to do that too?
No.
There was a copycat.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I haven't got the name of the original one on this article. The news article I'm reading here, they haven't actually got her name because she's a minor.
Okay.
But the person that done it after was a 24-year-old called...
Oh, for fuck's sake!
Called Deandrin LeQuinn Anderson of Port Arthur, Texas. He opened containers of Bluebell ice cream, sticking them back in the freezer shelves, and apparently it's a bit of a fad in 2019 because there were other cases of people doing this. Of going into shops and just...
Why?
Because people are fucking weird and stupid and they get quote-unquote clout for it. Like people...
Some people are so desperate to be famous.
Yeah, well, it's people that have gone in, get mouthwash, open it, chug it, spit it back in, put it back on the shelf.
Oh.
And there's another one of some girl going around belching on stuff as well.
Oh, people are gross. Yeah. I'm never touching anything ever again. I'm going to get one of those grabbers like you pick rubbish up with.
Well, people kind of... They stopped doing it now.
Good.
Because Deandrin LeQuinn Anderson... Port Arthur, Texas. He pled guilty to criminal mischief and sentenced to 30 days in jail for licking a half gallon of vanilla Bluebell ice cream, and he had to pay fines of over $2,000. Pay $1,000 and a restitution of $1,565 to Bluebell Creameries themselves. Food tampering is no joke. We will not tolerate tampering with our products, the company said. A 36-year-old Louisiana man has also been arrested for doing the same thing!
Oh dear.
That's all for me. Don't lick ice cream unless you bought it.
You've been listening to Deviant, a true crime podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. If you'd like to interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter at DeviantCrimePod. Instagram at DeviantCrimePodcast or email us at DeviantCrimePodcast@gmail.com. We are a new project working to develop and would love to hear from you. Thanks again for listening.